We've now got a discussion between Robin Hanson and James Hughes. And this is on Futarchy versus Plutarchy. Vote on values or pay to play. So just to introduce the two participants here. So we have the man who wants to replace politicians with prediction markets. And Robin Hanson has just been discussing that over the last hour and a half. He argues that if we want better results, we need to stop listening to talk and start looking at the odds. He believes Futarchy is the cure for political incompetence. That might be a bit of a characterisation. Sorry if it is. But we also have James Hughes in the other corner here. He asks the haunting question, in a system where bets determine policy, does the person with the biggest wallet get the loudest voice? As a sociologist focused on the ethical future of humanity, James challenges us to consider if we are fixing democracy or accidentally auctioning it off. So it's efficiency versus equity, markets versus masses. Please welcome Robin Hanson and James Hughes.
Hola.
Hello. Okay, so I guess, James, you're not having a particular proposal you'd like us to consider here so much. You're more critiquing this alternative.
Well, quickly, I could sketch out what I've been thinking about the last year or so. That
please,
since the AI agent framework has been coming into shape, coming into to picture, to focus, I've been thinking a lot about how agency through artificial intelligence is could be liberatory in a democratic context, but is also problematic. I mean, most of the discussion has been about how AI is a threat to democracy, automated propaganda, things like that. But I think one of the big problems I've always seen in democratic practice is that none of us have the time or, frankly, the interest to stay educated about all the different opportunities and threats to us in the policy domain and what the different options would be actually be. And as a consequence, we try to delegate that responsibility to third parties, to political parties, non-governmental organizations. I think some of that delegation could go towards your own personal bot, your own personal avatar in the space. And there would be significant advantages if we could have bots which epistemically were paying attention to the things that need to be paid attention to, bringing them to our attention, and then framing the various options that we have for intervening politically. And so I see this as kind of citizen bots that are protecting us from disinformation, finding things that we need to know, and then connecting us to non-governmental organizations, political parties, writing letters to the editor, managing our political influence. And that model is partly inspired by Alistair Reynolds, who's a science fiction author, and he has a species called the Demarchists, who have a little brain-computer interface. And it's constantly voting on their behalf in a kind of plebiscitory democracy, which is running 24/7. And I think the advantage of that, of thinking about democracy that way, is that democracy has very high demands, and most of us can't or won't meet those demands. But we would like to have tools which would help us meet those demands. So that's where the direction I've been thinking, that an AI-facilitated kind of citizenship interface.
So let's talk about that. So far in democracy, people have tried to delegate their democratic choices. For example, most people have a set of friends and associates who they consult about their votes. Then there are political organizations that they trust to advise them. And then, of course, representative democracy is the whole point of, instead of directly making decisions, you are picking someone to represent you instead. For all of these things, the key issue is, to what extent can you judge the quality of these representatives given your limited knowledge and abilities? That's the key sticking point. If you don't know any better about how to evaluate their advice than you do about making your direct choices, it's not really going to help. So you might say, well, if you just know it's a great AI, okay, but if it's a great AI that's great at pandering to your preconceptions and inclinations, which many of them today are, then it's going to tell you what it thinks you want to hear, which is also, of course, what activist groups do and media groups do and representatives do.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that people have been doing for a long time is saying, okay, just set aside all your preconceptions. Here's 20 issues. What do you think about these 20 issues? And then they match that set of answers to politicians. And often right. the results are, oh, you actually should like this politician because they agree with you more than this one over here. And most people, because of their tribal identifications with liberalism, conservatism, political parties, they don't think that way about actual issues, even though they say they want to. And so I think one of the potential benefits of this kind of an AI-assisted democracy model is that it could do that kind of dispassionate matching and judging for you and say, you know, really, you should be a Green, or really, you should be a libertarian, rather than you, whatever tribal identity you had.
Right. But if now people who should be a Green don't think they should be a Green because their parents were something else, if the AI realizes that too, it's not going to tell them this thing because they know it doesn't want to hear it, right?
Well, yeah, that depends on the level of sycophancy, I suppose. That's sycophancy is
yes,
a huge problem.
That's the key problem.
Yeah.
Now, there's a... So I got my PhD in formal political theory a while ago, but one standard result was that retrospective voting actually can be much better informed than prospective voting. That is, if people would just even look at their personal lives and re-elect an incumbent when that went better than expected, that embodies a lot of information about how the incumbent has actually been helping your world. And unfortunately, people aren't very inclined to just do this simple retrospective voting. And of course, it does require a pretty centralized power that you are evaluating. If you've got, you know, if you're one guy you're voting for has only a tiny influence on everything, then you're asking how your life went won't really help very well. But with a centralized power and retrospective voting, you can do a lot better. But I don't really see necessarily how an AI is going to help you do retrospective voting better. And people don't seem very inclined to do that either. So,
well, if retrospective voting means we get to do over the 2024 election, that's that would be a great thing, especially given the current polling.
Right. I mean, the retrospective voting is to say, look who's in power, and then when the next election, say, am I better or worse off than I should have expected to be in this situation, and then vote for the incumbent if you're better and against the incumbent if you're not. So
Biden by a landslide.
You can certainly believe that people should see that they are worse off, but that's the harder problem. Now, so my proposal is to separate information and values. So I think you'll accept the claim that our current form of government accepts a place for expert knowledge in having government agencies be expert, where we're not relying on ordinary voters to have all the expert information that agencies do. So we're more relying on voters to set overall priorities and goals of the agencies, but the detailed expert knowledge we are not expecting to be embodied in voters per se. We expect them to oversee the choice of people who would find and apply that expert knowledge. So when I say my slogan of Futarchy is vote on values, bet on beliefs, I'm saying that on the beliefs part, yes, ordinary people won't have an equal voice, but that's like the government agency part. That's the knowledge about what works. But voters would still have their equal strong influence as much as today on the priorities and values, so that we will just now let voters choose what outcomes we're looking for and then let the people who speculate in the markets decide which policies are effective at those outcomes. So that's a way I might say Futarchy is still being democratic and egalitarian in terms of influence about the key values that the system is going to try to achieve.
Yeah, well, I think in the information inequality within any society, there's always going to be people who know a lot more about things than others. And that information...
And we want to take advantage of that. We want the people who know more to have more influence.
Right, and so there's always a balance between expertise, the role of expertise in governance versus the role of citizen panels or citizens in general. So I agree with that, but I think part of the problem has been conceptualizing whether experts have interests of their own. And we're currently in a moment where there's an anti-expertise upsurge in the United States, and partly because of the perception that experts have interests, which they do. And I mean, I think the perception that climate scientists are all interested in promoting climate science because there's some green socialist cabal is absurd. But experts, are compromised by, for instance, who paid for their research. And so we definitely want to know those things. So there's always that democratic balance that needs to occur to the expertise, that experts can be cherry-picked by the powers that be in order to do the things that they want them to do. So there's never a slam dunk here about the role of experts versus citizen input. And I'm not benign either about citizens. I think the role of citizen science panels, for instance, is quite mixed. Sometimes they can contribute meaningfully to elaborating on whether a technology should be used or not, and sometimes they just double down on their prayers. So I don't think there's a perfect solution, right. But I do think that liberal democracy in general is the better solution. And so we want representative governments that we can change through elections and free speech and all the accoutrements of liberal democracy go along with having a well-informed state.
So let's go into the details here. So we agree that it's proper for voters straight to decide the priorities, but that we need some informed input, which is unequal, which taps into how much people actually know about the consequences of policy in order to set the details of policy. And now, in the current situation, what we tend to do is we go on ordinary voters' perceptions of who's informed, so that, various agencies have employees and commissions who have standard credentials, say educational degrees, and they're eager to do that in order to convince voters that those people are, in fact, more expert. But those are often poor estimates of who's actually knows better about the particular questions at issue.
Right.
And my claim is that the betting markets just do a lot better at soliciting the actual experts to be the ones who set the answers to the what works question.
Well, so I don't think we can replace...
It's about a different way to do
that.
I don't
think we can replace FDA review panels with betting markets and whether...
Yes, you can. You definitely can. That's my claim. You can do that. And that's what we should be considering.
A betting market among the people who would otherwise be voting on whether to approve a drug?
A betting market on anybody who wants to participate in that, because the markets do a good job of getting people to self-select who knows more. So, yes. If we'd say, conditional on approving this drug, what will be the consequences of that? That's what the panel is voting on. They are trying to estimate, if we approve this drug, what's the chance of, side effects we didn't anticipate? What's the checks of, the chances of actual, therapeutic advantages that we are hoping for? Chances the costs will go up. They're estimating those things, and speculative markets could estimate those things better.
Well, I'm for the research. I didn't oppose when you were trying to get the DOD to do this back 20 years ago. I thought that was a reasonable proposal. So,
but I mean, just to be clear, I think there's a hope for big applications like this in the long run, but I am not suggesting that's the first thing we do.
Good.
I'm suggesting let's go through a sequence of smaller trials and evaluations of those, and then as we gain confidence in their accuracy and powers and avoiding whatever problems we fear and are looking for, that we then apply them in wider scopes as they passed smaller scale tests.
In the meantime, I don't think proposing betting markets as an FDA adjudication process is superior to the other kinds of reform proposals that we've got. I mean, we've got a lot of work to do in things like the FDA.
But we could just start having a parallel markets and seeing their advice and not having them be in control in order to start collecting a data set about how well they do in forecasting these things. That's a thing we could start with, advisory markets, and just test how well they're doing. And we could do that in a wide range of government policy areas.
Mm-hmm. And the problems of insider trading, though, you think that could be just regulate, the people who play the games would be regulated to not have insider information or something?
Well, Well, insider trading is about who should keep what secrets. Honestly, I'm not seeing that many secrets we need kept in FDA regulation. It's mainly in the military where you might worry about making sure secrets are kept. But I think if insiders trade about FDA drug approval things, that's great. I don't see any reason not to have the markets fully reflect everything everybody knows about the consequences of approving a drug.
Well, wouldn't the risk there be more the gaming of the process by voting, you know, strategic voting?
You mean voting on what decision is made?
Strategic betting, being like, you know, we're trying to influence the outcome in one direction, so we'll put a heavy bet that direction.
Yeah. Just to be clear, I'm interested in betting about the consequences of actions, not about what. So if you have a vote on the panel and people can bet on what the vote's going to be, then yes, they could bet on their own vote and make money on
if they're voting
their
on
vote
whether
to win
a drug
bet,
should be approved, right? That's
right.
A decision.
But I just want bets on the consequences of approving a drug. Like, if this drug is approved in this level at this time,
the FDA panel would say, we're going to take a vote on whether to approve this drug, or we're going to run a betting market on whether, if it's approved, it would cause people to die or something like that. That's what you want?
All the consequences we're interested in about approving a drug, yes, we should not only try to measure them later, we should have markets earlier that try to estimate them, and I don't see any problem with that being as fully informed as possible.
If that's the extent of the proposal, that's fine. I don't see that as anti-democratic. As long as the corporations aren't voting, as long as rich people aren't putting their thumb on the scale, yeah, why not?
But as they become more accepted to be predictive, then they will start to be more influential. So, for example, there's this website called Snapshot, where crypto DAO companies vote on proposals to change policies for their DAOs. And that has had a roughly six times in the last year, I believe, when, no, 11 times, sorry, because I just asked for the details. They've had a vote on a particular proposal to a DAO, and they've had at the same time betting markets on whether passing that proposal will in fact help this DAO's coin value. And quite consistently, the votes go with the market. The markets have become influential. People, when they see that the market thinks that this way will help the coin, they vote that way. So it's not in power. It doesn't control. It's advisory only. But as it collects a better track record, it becomes influential. And that same thing could happen for the FDA drug approvals.
Well, just to get back to first principles here, I think the biggest problem with democracy and with democratic influence, and perhaps even before that, the goal of democracy is to have for us all to have equal influence over policy so that policy reflects our collective interests. Now, we're not great at knowing our own interests, but insofar as we do, policy should be better if we have equal access to it. And the prior problems then with democratic empowerment is that we don't know what our interests are. We don't know how to achieve them. There's an information inequality in society. And then there's an influence inequality because the wealthy control the institutions of the state. They can contribute to politicians. They have more access to the media and so forth. And so I just see the betting market stuff as peripheral to my central concerns with democratic empowerment, which is how do we make a political system, a political economy, in which people have more equal influence within the political system, where we overcome the backroom networks that we see at work in the Epstein class, where we have collective institutions of empowerment that are equally influential to the associations of corporations or the associations of the wealthy. And so the kinds of societies that have achieved that, I think, is Northern Europe, have the highest standard of living in the world, longest life expectancies, free societies, you know, liberal democracy, everything you want. And so for the last 50 years, the closer we can get to Northern Europe's standard of democratic empowerment, the better. Of course, it could be better, and they're experimenting with things too. But we seem to be at a real nadir of democratic empowerment in the United States. So I'm always interested in experiments. Ranked choice voting is an interesting experiment and has had some salutary effects. Mail-in voting, non-synchronous voting practices, all interesting experiments. But the fundamental problem is the fact that the wealthy control the state and what we can do to overcome that. So I just don't see the markets as really addressing that central concern.
I'm trying to focus on a distinction here between two contributions to policy. One contribution is the overall goals that we're trying to achieve, and the other is the particular policies and what outcomes they will have as a consequence of those policies. I'm claiming that it's appropriate for voters to set the first and then equal contribution to everybody on that is more appropriate, but that for the details of which policies have which effects, voters are quite badly informed and information is not at all equally distributed, and we want the people with more information to have more influence about that second part of policy. And typically the way governments go badly is that we do bad on that second part, often because we're relying on public opinion about it. So let's take the example of invading Iraq a long time ago, if you remember that. I would say there were experts who knew a fair bit about the consequences of that, but that public opinion supported this policy because in the opinion of the public, this policy made sense in terms of what consequences they thought it would have. So, yes, there were interests pushing for that policy to happen, but it wouldn't have happened without the president taking the initiative to do it with an expectation the public would support him, which they did. Then we had a bad aggregation of information about the consequences of the policy because we were relying on public's expectation about the consequences. We weren't just asking the public to say, what do you want in terms of oil prices, soldier deaths, you know, things in the future. We said, do you think this war is a good idea? And the public said, yeah. And that's the problem, because we were asking public both about outcomes and methods, and democracy goes wrong when the public has too much say over methods because they don't really know as much about
methods. So you're saying the public was bamboozled into Iraq, but experts would not have been if they had been in a betting market?
That's right. Yes, that's what I would say. And also true for many other policy, that is, we did
the chairman
some stuff
of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was bamboozled into Iraq. Isn't he an expert?
I would think the people willing to bet in the markets would have paid more attention and learned more. So, like, you know about, say, in this last presidential election, how the betting markets did better than the typical mainstream media poll aggregators because some particular bettors did it extra work at researching and finding information that the pollsters hadn't had access to. That's the sort of thing that betting markets consistently do, and financial markets have consistently done for a long time. That's roughly what we know about the accuracy of financial market prices, is they induce people to do this extra work that isn't typically done either by government staffers or journalists in their judgments.
Do you think AI is going to do better than betting markets in a year or two?
As I was telling Adam before, there's a distinction between methods and forums. So methods are what you would use or a machine would use to make your best forecast. And a forum is a place in which people with different forecasts come in and compete, and some aggregate summary is produced from that process. I've been focused on designing forums, and for that purpose, I don't need to pay that much attention to particular methods. But when better methods appear, the forum is healthy. It will just allow those better methods to win out, and then the forum will now become dominated by the better methods. So prediction markets don't have to decide whether humans or AIs will be the best participants in them. Same way for ordinary financial markets. We will just see when AIs start to beat people at key tasks, then they will just displace them on those tasks, and the markets will continue to forecast just as they have, and we can treat the market forecasts the same way we did before, even if AI is now the main contributor.
Good. Let's do it.
Are you worried that AI, people will learn to trust AI if it does end up dominating prediction markets, once an overwhelming amount of trust has been gained in for the AI by the general populace, then the frontier labs will bias the extrapolation base or bias the what they're actually learning to make the predictions, to make predictions which are in the favor of those controlling the labs.
At the moment, we have financial markets and we have people who would like to bias, say, the price of particular stocks because they would gain from that. And the people who trade and make the most money in the financial markets, if they go separately and try to make a newsletter and say, you should just trust me, I'm good in the markets, people have a choice of trusting the newsletter or just looking at the market price. And typically the market price is better than the newsletter. And people who try to manipulate financial market prices just consistently fail overall. And we have good data and theory about why that's true. So as soon as these labs start to try to bias their contributions to the markets because they're big players, then that's exactly the point at which the others will take advantage of their biases and undo that in the aggregate market estimates. That's the power of these markets to resist and feed off of manipulation. So it turns out that when people try to manipulate speculative market prices, including prediction markets, the prices get more accurate, not less. And that's quite in contrast to most of the other institutions we know of, including polls and committees and expert reports, etc. Those are often biased by somebody paying to try to distort them. And speculative markets have the opposite effect. They become more accurate when people try to distort them.
Yeah, but there might be a lag between the time. There might be a
no,
lag.
No, there is no lag.
No lag.
We have data on these things, no lags. It's about when people expect the manipulation. So if people are surprised and there is more manipulation than they expect, then they will be doing less efforts to counter the manipulation because they aren't expecting it. But I think that's not a time lag so much as a mismatch of expectation. But I would think relatively quickly there's a sudden burst in manipulation activities and people don't expect that burst, then they will for a time underreact to it. But that would also be true if there was a sudden deficit of it. They would be overreacting. We have many, you know, processes like that in the competitive world.
In liquid democracy, I think people follow experts and basically trust them to vote on their behalf, if I'm not wrong. I wonder if people will learn to trust super forecasters, including AIs and humans, to place bets on these prediction markets instead of just each one making an individual choice in them on their own. And if that's the case, once there's an overwhelming trust in a super forecaster or an AI, they become points that can be leveraged to manipulate the markets quite substantially, because each vote isn't like an individual actor. It's more like, all these people trusting or barracking for a particular actor who votes on their behalf.
I think that's part of what I was thinking about in terms of AI agents as our intermediaries in democracy, that we would learn to trust our AI agent as a political actor on our behalf by monitoring how well they've done. And they, in turn, would be following the signals from trusted expert sources of information and political guidance out in the field, presumably ones that are consistent with your own value system. So I think there is trust all along the chain here, but it starts with you trusting that the AI is going to work on your behalf. And by the way, Super Bowl ads, it seems to be relevant here that Anthropic went after OpenAI because of OpenAI's decision to start selling advertising. And the nature of the ads that they ran were that, what if your AI results start to be compromised by the financial incentives of the advertisers that OpenAI is contracting with, which has been a concern with Google and with, sponsored ad search results and things like that. So I think that this could be a lot more insidious, the effect of commercial incentives on distorting what AIs tell us about the world. So I just see that this problem scales up, that the problem of financial influence over the kinds of information and the decisions that we make scales up. And I worried that it scales also in betting markets, but I'm willing to do the betting market experiments. I just don't think that they're terribly germane to fixing the problems of democracy, which is how do we organize people to counteract the enormous power of wealth.
So we see a different main problem. I see the big mistakes we've made as mistakes that were widely supported. And in fact, I mean, we have literature that says, you know, the rich have a disproportionate influence on policy. I presume you know about that. That is, over time, elites have more influence on policy outcomes than the median voter or poor people.
I do.
And yet we've made some big mistakes, and it's because those people have just been wrong about the consequences of policy. And it's less about them sort of slanting things in their favor and more about us just doing stupid things like invading Iraq when there was expert knowledge suggesting otherwise. So I, as an economist, I think I know about many areas of regulation where we're just being stupid, not really helping the rich, not really helping the poor, just not helping anybody just by doing stupid things because of a widespread perception that they're not stupid things. That's where I see the biggest problems in the world, and you know, and that as a futurist, I see us facing bigger problems coming, and I would like us to have more competent governance, by which I mean governance that wasn't misinformed about the consequences of its actions.
And but you agree,
yes,
that the,
there
the,
are often conflicts.
That the wealthy have more power over the state.
And they have, yes, and they have for a long time, and nevertheless, we still have stupid policies. But they're not about, mostly not the rich trying to gain advantage over the poor. They're just about the rich doing what they think is best, which is just wrong. And so the poor at the time didn't have better opinions per se. They just were less influential. I just think we just have been consistently doing stupid stuff because of democracy relying on ordinary voters or even elite voters' opinions about what's effective, as in, say, Iraq.
So the problem with democracy is too much ordinary voter influence? Is that the way you frame it?
On how things work rather than the values. Again, vote on values, bet on beliefs is my slogan. Let's keep democracy going for how we decide what our priorities are, and then have a better way to aggregate information about the consequences of our actions.
So the public wants immigration control, but they didn't want people executed in the streets, and that's the way it's getting implemented. And you think what? Voting markets would show that we didn't want to execute people in the street, and that would have a check on the state somehow?
A futarchy metric related to immigration would include its effects on the economy, its effects on culture, and yes, the cost of enforcement. So a metric about that would evaluate any particular policy about, say, the recent immigration policy according to its expectation about its effect on those metrics. And if you think that, in fact, the harms in enforcement would have been seen as a larger harm than the gains of this policy with respect to culture or the economy, then futarchy would have said, no, that doesn't look like a good idea.
How about Citizens United, Robin? Do you think we should restrict the ability of big corporations and the wealthy to contribute to political campaigns?
That's actually about information institutions. So the question is, you know, as you may know, constitutional law has allowed more free speech near politics because of the idea that without a free competition of opinions in politics, we won't be able to make political choices well, and then the entire society won't go well. So, for example, alcohol companies are not allowed to advertise the fact that typically people who drink the least amount of alcohol are less healthy than the people who drink a bit more, because the FDA has decided that would be misleading, and they just don't have a free speech right about that, and the court says, yeah, that's not near politics, so fine, let them regulate it. But it's closer to politics where the courts have said, you got to let them talk if they want to talk, because that's how politics works. And Citizens United is saying, if you're going to let people talk, you have to let them use institutions that organize to let people talk. You just don't let people stand on the street and talk. They have to be able to use media and publishing and the sorts of systems that we have that are capitalist by which people can organize to spread their word. That was Citizens United. And I have to say, yes, our modern information world doesn't seem very easily regulated by just preventing people from talking through organized institutions. With the court, I don't see how that would work.
Well, it works in lots of societies by having caps on how much people can spend on elections and having public financing of elections. So I think it could work here exactly the same way it works in Europe. So,
but it would be greatly constraining free speech.
It would be constraining.
The United States has leaned into
the free speech of billionaires to buy for $44 billion their own communication platform and turn people right wing with it, which is what we've seen with Twitter, right?
The point is, everyone has the ability to use, social media and mass media.
Not all of us have the ability to buy them
word.
Or own them or turn them right wing.
That's right. Yeah.
So,
that's
intervening.
That's a fault of those information institutions.
Intervening to make a more equal information landscape and saying billionaires should not be able to do that, I think that could be a part of democracy, too. You're a free speech absolutist. Every billionaire gets a billion votes.
When I look at our various information institutions, I would like to see them competing and trying variations. So the history of governments limiting information institutions for the benefit of the public hasn't been very good. They've typically limited them for their own incumbent benefits. That's the history of governments taking control of the media, of schools, etc. Government heavy regulation of information institutions has typically been in the service of preserving incumbents' status and messages. So in the face of that history, I'm going to be more open to just letting different information institutions try different things and seeing what people are willing to trust. Yes.
But the Orban model that the Trump fascists are following is to have your siloviki, your powerful men, control the media institutions on your behalf, right? So Larry Ellison is buying Warner Brothers, Paramount, CNN, Musk bought X, Zuckerberg controls the Meta empire. So basically by forming political alliances with billionaires who then buy all the media institutions, you control the information landscape. So for you to say governments should never get involved in regulating the media, at least antitrust, right? Well, how about this Paramount Warner Brothers deal? Do you think there should be an antitrust claim that maybe one billionaire shouldn't control that much media?
We have a world of politics and a world of commerce, and they both are unequal. And I would rather they just both were more open to competition. So if we let politics shut down commerce competition, and then we have the inequality of politics deciding what happens in commerce and politics, I'd rather let there be competition in the world of commerce, including in the world of media commerce.
You think there's no affirmative argument for restricting Musk's interference in politics except the free speech argument that if you say anything boo to him, you're restricting free speech? That's the only concern that you have?
I mean, there's lots of speech critical of Musk. We definitely don't have a world where that's prevented. I have heard a great deal of criticism of Musk, and that's in a world where there is a wide range of different voices being heard about Musk and Trump and everything else. So I don't think we're in a world where different people can't try to say things, but I will say that information institutions can be improved, and the whole point of prediction markets is to try to introduce a more effective information institutions into our set of available ones. But I think letting government shut down journalism is not a general approach to the fact that journalism can have problems, because government can often be worse when it shuts down journalism. So I would just allow the open competition here of different voices and things trying to gain.
So the FCC's strong arm techniques against major corporations to get them to take people off the air, you're opposed to that too, I assume.
Sure. As I was to previous administrations, strong-arming of social media.
So you think Trump should have been left on X when during COVID, when he was telling people to inject chlorine and shit?
I would have allowed more such things, yes. But one of the ways in which we regulate speech is through defamation and fraud sort of rules, and we've had a long history of those laws, but they have often been misused, so I am a bit worried about using defamation and fraud to limit speech.
Neo-Nazi propaganda?
That's a problem.
What about?
Well, if that's not false.
It's free speech.
Defamation and fraud, we're talking about things that are false. Yeah. Neo-Nazi propaganda is presumably just people advocating for particular political systems or outcomes, just and that's not
straight
false,
up free
so I wouldn't
speech.
Recommend regular. Yeah, of course.
But these are private platforms, so they can set their own policies, right? They could say, we're not going to do Nazi propaganda.
I think the concentration of social media is a serious issue to be considering. That is, I am open to thinking about ways to regulate social media to address the network effects producing strong concentration there, although I haven't actually seen a concrete proposal that I feel that safe with. As you may know, a century ago, most cities had a single main newspaper because that was the economically efficient way to do ads, and that gave a pretty centralized control over the media in a city. We didn't do anything much about that then, but I'm not sure what we could have exactly done then. But I would be interested in hearing what proposals people even would have had then to deal with that. But we've had these eras of concentration of media, and as far as I can see, the sort of free speech solution was better than the other things that were tried at the time. I mean, I would bet there were places where the mayor wanted to control the main newspaper because of the excuse of a single concentrated media, but I doubt that went better.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that nationalizing or municipalizing the city newspaper is the solution, but I do think we need an attention to alternative sources of media that are free right. from these corrosive...
The best thing I've heard that I find most hopeful is the idea of letting users of a social media thing pick a feed algorithm that is then used to set their feed. It seems like that would be feasible.
Yes.
That is within a limited range of algorithms, at least that were compatible with the data structures they used to represent things, that it would be possible to just say, hey, you can specify a feed, and there may be some cost for someone to create a feed algorithm, but given that cost, you can pick it. And that seems to me a reasonable compromise, allowing these sites to be big and concentrated, but letting users pick a feed.
I like that proposal. And in fact, the EU in the AI Act has adopted that every major algorithm, preference algorithm out there, should give you the alternative of turning the algorithm off and just going back to a straight chronological feed. I don't find, in something like Facebook, where I've got 5,000 friends, I don't find a straight chronological feed to be at all feasible or
right.
useful.
Right. But it does seem like other feed algorithms would be feasible. And not all algorithms are feasible. It's important for people to understand the computer science of this. They have to have a data structure by which they represent things and by which they index things. And only feed algorithms that match the indexing structure they're using could be efficient feed algorithms. But I still think there would be many feed algorithms that would be consistent with however they're indexing.
And a lot of the...
And they would have to reveal their indexing to some degree to allow these algorithms. They can't keep their indexing secret because then you wouldn't know how to write an algorithm that matched their index.
And a lot of the platforms already give you that option. When you're setting it up, in Spotify, you say, what kinds of music in general right. are you interested in? So you give them some clues about your algorithm before you even get the behavioral data.
Right. So that's, I'm most hopeful about that because that seems like it doesn't shut down anybody's speech per se. And it's just about the space of feed algorithms that can be feasibly implemented. Now, I do expect they might limit how they index things to limit the number of feed algorithms that compete against their main one, and then we might have to have an argument about saying, no, you have to index it these other ways too. But that's a secondary thing. First, I might just say, given whatever indexing you're using, let's allow other people to make algorithms in that to set your feed.
I think your example of the town newspaper is a useful one because this is always the first question that I ask in tech ethics debates is this any different from what we did before? And in terms of information, we're definitely living in an information surplus era as opposed to our predecessors who maybe saw one newspaper ever or something like that. So I do think that that is an important place to start, is that we have improved in our access to all kinds of different kinds of information. And what we need to do is find the sources that actually fit with us. So I like your idea of algorithmic choice. But I think when I think about my experience on TikTok this last year, it gives me the pessimism, which is that I've been looking at TikTok carefully to see whether the choices that I've made are still going to be reflected when Larry Ellison gets his fingers on the algorithm. And I presume that he will be even more suppressive of anti-MAGA views, whether he actually turns off particular accounts or not, or kicks them off the platform. He will definitely downvote or, you know, suppress or shadow ban, as is already happening on X, certain kinds of topics and accounts. And I think that that's far more insidious. I'm far more worried about that kinds of ideological hegemony exercised on the part of the wealthy through these mechanisms, where it's, we can't even tell anymore. With the town newspaper, you could tell. You knew who owned it. You knew who was writing for it. You knew that the opinions were all favoring whatever, you know, whoever owned it. But today, it's like you're getting 5,000 things a day, and they start shifting to become more conservative, and you don't even recognize it or realize it. So I think that's the more insidious threat of today's information, potential techno-fascist model.
So we've been talking about censorship and, you know, less direct control over media feeds and the degree to which powerful sources can slant them in some direction or another. I'm actually more worried about a more basic thing that's harder to change, which is just that the whole world is becoming more integrated as a culture and via these means of shared communication. That is, over the last few centuries, we've had more talk, travel, and trade around the world. And so the world is just converging on more of a world culture. And at that scale, I don't know that Larry Ellison has an enormous influence, but we are all converging on a shared culture, which then is going to make the world a fragile monoculture with respect to cultural evolution. And I don't know how to, I don't know how to induce a fragmentation of the world's communication and culture. They're just, especially,
I hope you're right about monoculture. I'm looking forward to the monoculture, Robin.
It might well be more congenial to you in the short run, but I just think you should think about the long run of what happens with a monoculture in the world continuing for a long time.
We're pretty far. The Chinese firewall is not just the technical difficulty getting out. It's that there's a Chinese internet, there's an Arab internet, there's a Russian internet. We're not converging terribly quickly.
But if you look at, say, the world of 3 centuries ago, the world of 2 centuries ago, the world of 1 century ago, I think you have to see an enormous convergence over the long timescales in the variety of culture around the world. We are now far more similar around the world than we were before.
I see Japanese people going to Korea to study K-pop so that they can do versions of black hip-hop, which was inspired by African music and Southern music, white people's music. So it's happening all
that
over.
That is a degree of integration,
It's happening. It's always been happening. It's happening all over. We're just a bunch of monkeys wandering around the planet. I'm not terribly concerned that we're all going to be able to speak the same language. In fact, that's one of the things I'm looking forward to, is seamless translation. You know, give me the babblefish.
Right. So, I mean, I think I'd have to elaborate. Last year, I gave a talk that was more about the culture problem, and so I didn't talk about that.
I didn't like
year.
That talk either. But
I think there are honestly bigger problems even than, you know, censorship that are at play, unfortunately, in the world. And yes,
you think cultural homogeneity is a bigger problem than censorship?
Yes, I do. And censorship is way down. I mean, I think we do have to admit that compared to, say, peasants from 3 centuries ago, or even national citizens from, you know, 2 centuries ago or 7 centuries ago, most ordinary people have access to a far wider range of information today.
Yes, I agree.
They can get it, you know, by searching the web, by YouTube videos, by a wide range of sources. And therefore, I see just much less scope for censorship effects than we had in previous centuries.
Nonetheless, most countries practice censorship of the press and the internet.
But it's much less effective than it was 2 centuries ago.
Something like 250 when journalists Romania murdered last year.
Right. When, say, a country like Romania 2 centuries ago limited what people could publish in Romania, Romanian peasants, like, they hardly saw anything, right? That was just very effective at limiting what a Romanian peasant could know about the world from what the Romanian government wanted them to know. And now the equivalent of a Romanian peasant can get information through all sorts of services that are not very influenced by the Romanian government.
True. But as I said, the Chinese internet firewall keeps a lot, 95% of Chinese from even being curious about what's happening outside the Chinese internet. So I do...
China's culture is not really that different from the West. So you and I know people who were eager to see genetic engineering, say, in the last few decades. And many of them saw how the West was heavily regulating genetic engineering. And they said, Chinese, they'll allow it. They don't have these religious problems with genetic engineering. But what we saw is the Chinese are eager to be accepted by the world in terms of many areas of policy. And they... went with regulating genetic engineering just like everybody
they
else. And that's true for most regulatory
areas.
They
slapped Dr. He on the wrist and let him out after 2 years, and he's back married to another cytogeneticist selling genetic engineering of kids. So it doesn't seem like they were terribly concerned about it.
I mean, as you know, cloning has been banned worldwide for several decades now, and you still can't go buy clones anywhere in the world for humans. And that's true in China as well as here. If you look at airline regulation in China, all sorts of lots of regulation in China isn't that different from the rest of the world. And lots of culture in China isn't that. They have the same fertility fall, dramatic, as the rest of Asia, and even worse than most of the world.
So you're saying China is subject to cultural homogeneity with the rest of the world, and that's making them weaker?
Indeed.
They should be more culturally autochthonous?
I mean, it's fertility that's their biggest problem now. That is, fertility is just going to take them down over the next half century. And
they definitely need immigrants. I agree with that. Yeah,
and they're not open to them. Yeah. And immigrants are increasingly hard to obtain. If you're in Asia looking for Asian immigrants, and all the Asian country fertility is falling, there's just not very many places you can try to get them from in Asia.
Right. And importing Koreans and Japanese isn't going to help at all.
And Africans, Chinese are just not going to be that open to importing African immigrants, yeah, which is one of the main places where there would be a lot of people. So, yeah.
What about India?
Indian fertility is below replacement now.
Yeah.
Remarkably enough.
Which is a good response to the few one-child fans that are out there, is that India did the same thing without having to go do draconian policies. I mean, it was briefly draconian, but it wasn't as draconian as the one-child policy.
Right. So I think if you look at a lot of trends like fertility around the world, you'll see, I guess, there must be a lot more cultural convergence than you might have realized, because there are just so many cultural trends that are shared around the world.
Well, insofar as the rolling back of patriarchy and the expansion of women's education and employment opportunities, I definitely think there's cultural convergence. And it's one of the principal things that's caused the fascist backlash around the world. Every fascist leader is promising to stop gender ideology, stop the trans pandemic, put women back in the kitchen and get them making babies again. So I do agree with you that there's a global cultural phenomenon of women's empowerment causing a freakout of patriarchal restoration.
Now, in the last year, I think there was this interesting study that used the World Value Survey to look at trends and values around the world in the last half century. And there was this one key dimension on which values have become more divergent around the world, and that really was the value aligned with
sexual freedom.
What you might call woke, right? Exactly. But that's... I mean, so that's
the Russians and the Africans divergence. Are getting more reactionary. Yeah.
Right. So that's, I have to admit, on that dimension, I see less cultural convergence, but I still have to predict that the elite countries are the future. So typically with cultural trends in history, elites lead the way. Other people tend to later on follow the initial move of the elites. And so that's what I have to predict here, is the Africans will cave and follow on with the elite attitudes on gender and sexual freedom. That's going to be my prediction. But at the moment, there is this spreading of opinion in the last half century on those.
Well, your mouth to God's ears. can't come soon enough. I mean, I think this is the extinction burst of patriarchy, but we'll have to see. You know what I mean by extinction burst? The kind of the last gasp before it dies.
Well, right. But if you like sort of the elite culture, elite European culture in the world, then you would like the cultural trends by seeing that the world's going to move in your direction. And I predict that, and that's what you can look forward to. I agree with that. I just think you should be a bit more worried about the long-term consequences of that.
And by that, you mean fertility?
As one key symptom, but it's a symptom of a deeper problem. So, but yes, by itself, it's a pretty big problem. And so, yes, I think you should be worried about long-term fertility trends.
I'm definitely worried about this.
I do think there are ways to fix it, but
Well, I'm worried about the stability of the redistributive social welfare state, and I think the old
yes, that's definitely at risk.
The old age
falling fertility.
Yeah, the old age dependency ratio is definitely a problem for that. So I think slowing down the rate of population decline is, I think, a legitimate public policy goal. And then the question is how. But I don't think patriarchal restoration is going to do it, and I don't think it would be the ideal way to do it. And I think what we need to figure out is how we can make it more possible for everyone who wants to have a family to have a family, because the average person in the world wants to have more kids than they can afford. And so if we could even get people up to what they could.
But people have record levels of wealth, so I just don't buy the story that they're not having kids because it's too expensive to have kids.
Really?
You're richer than we ever were, and we're having fewer kids than ever, so I just don't think it can be because of expense. People in the past had more kids on far less income and
resources. Well, we can't, you know, as opposed to 200 years ago, we can't work our kids, most countries, to make a profit off of them. And so they're a net.
That kids were never a net profit for
Well, for agricultural labor, they were, in fact.
No, the kids ate more than they could produce in the field. Kids were not net productive even in agriculture.
Well, they were a lot closer to breaking even than they would have been when you banned child labor and industrial labor.
But we did that a long time ago, and fertility falls happened way after that.
Right.
So yes, banning child labor happened a long time
ago. Yeah, but it's one factor. So there's one economic factor on the table. There is a decline of marriage. I think that the decline of mating and marriage is, you know, key here as well. But that is also partly economic, that women looking for men who have stable enough employment careers to be married.
Men had a lot more income half a century ago than they do
today.
That's
right. There was more marriage half a century ago than there is today.
I mean, today, even if men have less than women today, men today have a lot higher incomes than they did 50 years
ago. But it's the precarity.
Complaining about men. Right. Well, so it's women earning more than men, which is what making women not want to marry the men, not that men aren't making a lot of money.
And I agree, yes. Women's equality is leading them to make different choices than they would have otherwise have made if their only choice was being poor or getting married or becoming a nun. So now that they have the choice of actually getting an education and employment, at least those women who have that choice, they're choosing not to get married. So I think we agree that you know, about the financial incentives that are on the table. And all I'm saying is we haven't tried yet giving young families the kinds of economic support that would actually change their decision making. And I think you, as an economist, must agree.
There's
some money, there's some point, right?
I agree, absolutely agree that enough money
would do it, right?
I agree, and enough money would in fact be win-win financially on net. And so it's culture that's making us not put up enough money here to do what it would take. I think another thing. If population does decline by several, you know, large factors, then innovation rates will also slow down a lot, and that threatens liberality. So I think in the last few centuries, one of the big things that happened was the most liberal nations were also the ones getting rich and powerful, and that induced much of the rest of the world to say, we have to do that too, otherwise we're not going to be able to keep up.
I agree. And I agree. There are many negative consequences of population decline.
And so liberality will probably decline.
But we can't fix liberality by locking women in the bedroom and saying you have to get married and you can't get an education. So right, we need to maintain women's empowerment and maintain liberality and try to reduce the effects of this population decline. And so the way to do that is to pay people to have kids.
So, I mean, one of the things people have noticed is that culture does influence fertility. And so one of the things I think I hear often is to say, okay, yes, culture has caused fertility decline, but I need you to agree that these parts of the culture we are not at all going to challenge, and it's only these parts of the culture that that are possible to change. Once you agree with me that, then I'm willing to consider fixing things.
You're saying the only possible solution to population decline that you would accept is to reduce or reverse women's empowerment.
I didn't say that at all. I'm saying everything's on the table for me.
Everything, including women's empowerment.
I think we have a
including women's empowerment.
Everything is on the table. Well, in democracy,
I think that's
a problem.
It's a problem if you're willing to negotiate away women's empowerment.
It's a problem if we go extinct. It's a problem if our civilization just gets replaced by others. The most likely long-term scenario, I think, is we get replaced by the Hereditum and the Amish, who have been doubling every 20 years for a while we are shrinking. Most likely, they will take over. And if you think the right is less liberal than the left in our world, wait till you see the Hereditum and the Amish running the world. It'll be far less liberal.
Well, I agree with you about
That's the actual stakes. Yeah. We have to find a way to revive growth, or that's who we lose to.
Okay. Well, what's your preferred way of reducing changing women's fertility choices then?
I would go with the money approach, but I would
Well, then we agree.
Basically
you don't want to take away that
I have
power.
A different money approach than you, baby. So I would just basically say give parents a substantial percentage, maybe a third, of their kids' future tax revenue as an asset they could transfer and sell to pay for parenting. So a big amount of money to parents that is proportional to how much they'll pay in taxes, and then that will induce them to rearrange their lives to get that money, and that may or may not reduce gender equality. I don't know. The point is, if it does, I'm willing to risk it because I would just like us to figure out how to solve the problem in as neutral and financial a way as possible. So this is my simple neutral way. Just transfer money, you know, to parents, but you know, as a percentage of their tax revenue, so that you have an incentive to produce kids who will, in fact, pay more taxes. And that would work, I think, to increase fertility. And I think it probably would, to some degree, reduce gender equality. But I don't know. But
how about a universal basic income for every member of a family, and in effect, paying parents to have kids?
It's about sort of how targeted a benefit is toward the problem you're interested in.
Universal is universal.
In general, with something like fertility, people often just pick a whole bunch of policies that are somewhat correlated with the problem. But if you diffuse your spending too much in a lot of weakly correlated policies, you don't actually very effectively address the problem. So I'm looking for the way to most directly pay for the thing you want and not indirectly pay for other stuff, which, you know, so that's why I would go with the thing I had. Not that I'm per se against these things, but I'm just worried. So, for example, some people say, well, we should subsidize, you know, less dense housing, or, you know, childcare. There's lots of things we could subsidize that, all else equal, would push in that direction. I just worry. It's a problem with democracy. Often we have ideas of things we want to promote, and then there's a grab brag of people trying to say, well, do my thing, it kind of related to your thing that you want to do, and then you end up spending a lot on all this grab bag of somewhat related things, but not actually being very effective at the thing you're trying to do. So that's why I'm going to be wary of correlates instead of just the direct thing.
Oh, I get it. But, you know, I'm in favor of universal basic income in general as a social policy, so it just seems like one of the derivative benefits of that would be if every kid in your family got one, then you would be that much richer.
Right. And that is correlated. I'm just not sure. You know, the question is, how much of a universal income could we afford? Like, are we willing to take away other benefits to replace it with that, or just add it on? That's my
You're painting a pretty dire picture of a declining fertility world. So it seems like you would really be willing to pay quite a bit to fix that.
But I might be willing to cut other benefits in order to raise that benefit. That is, I generally think UBI is attractive as a substitute and replacement for some other kinds of benefits, but
only if
there's
it eats
the issue
the
of whether you just add it on. And the question is how targeted. So I do think many of our other kinds of benefits are targeted to particular kinds of problems and beneficiaries, and a risk of UBI is that it's not very targeted. So you end up diffusing spending
It's considered a virtue by some, but yes.
Right. But a lot of the support for many kinds of social spending is based on certain targeted populations people think are legitimately deserve
a lot
help.
Of the lack of support. That's the reason Medicaid is half as supported as Medicare, right? And that's why universal basic income would be more supported than either. And so I think that's one of the arguments for universality as opposed to means testing.
Right. But notice, I actually think my opinions on these things shouldn't carry that much weight. I want to produce something like Futarchy where we agree on the outcome metrics and then people more expert than I or you actually figure out what's most effective at achieving them. And then if we've chosen our outcomes well, we should be okay with that. I don't know whether UBI would be better than these other things, but if we set up a, say, metric that has fertility, has growth, has liberty, et cetera, as the metrics we are trying to achieve, then it should be able to figure out which of these policies would be more effective at achieving those goals. That's exactly the whole hope here, is that we can have a kind of governance where even the opinion of people like you and I, professors of these things, our opinion is not what drives these things. It's people even more expert than us.
Okay. You know, back when I was when I published Citizen Cyborg, I was invited to Sweden by both the Social Democratic think tank and a libertarian think tank because the proposal that I had made about how to reform healthcare was coming out of the Clinton proposals. The idea that you should be able to choose among a set of different kinds of healthcare plans. And I think that that is a general issue in the design of public provision systems and state systems, is that we should maximize choice in every place that we can. And I think that's part of the charter school debate, whether within public education systems you can have sufficient amounts of choice that people are looking for as parents. And within a healthcare system, choosing between different kinds of plans. But I see choice as a desirable thing that we can accomplish within public provision, within universal limits on how much you're allowed to put in. Like with the Clinton proposal was the different distance between a bottom premium and a top premium was, it could only be like 100%. You couldn't have plans that were five times more expensive than the cheapest plan out there. And I think those kinds of restraints on the choices that people make are entirely legitimate.
I think it would be an interesting exercise for you and I, say, to try to work out a Futarchy outcome metric, maybe with some dials to represent points of disagreement. But I expect, for example, we would take people at different income levels, and you would want to put larger weights on the consequences for people at lower income levels. And I actually don't think that would be so bad. That is, that might not be my favorite choice, but I actually think we wouldn't actually be losing that much by pushing in that egalitarian direction if we were actually to do it efficiently across all the other dimensions of policy. So it is this key dimension that many people really focus on as the source of their fighting. And I think, unfortunately, that just distracts from all these other dimensions of inefficiency. So as you know, I have proposed reforms for medicine that I would be quite radical, but they wouldn't much disagree with attempts to sort of emphasize the outcomes for the poor more. That's not going to get in the way of my proposals. But I think we're just missing on all the ways in which medicine is crazy inefficient. Focusing so much on trying to reassure each other that we are being appropriately egalitarian.
You know, I actually propose something similar to that, which is that I'm a big fan of consequentialist ways of judging things, including healthcare. And of course, in bioethics, the quality or quality adjusted life year has been a central idea in how we judge the efficacy of different systems. But in terms of the bringing egalitarianism into the equation, what you suggested is precisely what we need to do, which is have a differential that weights a result that moves things for the poor more than it moves things for the rich. So in other words, if you were able to bring down the blood sugar of people who are already healthy compared to the blood sugar of people who are diabetic, it's far more important to bring down diabetics' blood sugar. So if you're poor, it's far more important to raise your welfare in certain things than it is to raise the welfare of people already advantaged. So I think that that is, in fact, the way we should be doing things.
Right. But people might try to measure qualias for medicine, but they are not actually driving policy to maximize that. There's very weak pressures to actually change policy to achieve that. If we could have much stronger pressures to actually effectively achieve qualias, I could be much more okay with
National Health Service is
no, they do not do a very good job.
They do a better job than we do. I mean, they follow their care guidelines a lot more strictly than we do.
Right. And they waste a lot less money. We spend a lot more money.
A third. They spend a third as much per capita as we do.
Right. Yeah. And we are mostly wasting that extra two-thirds, I'm happy to admit.
Right. And one of the so you think that the British National Health Service is actually more efficient as a system?
The world is getting a benefit from the U.S.'s overspending on medicine. So, if the U.S. would stop overspending on medicine, then I think world medical innovation would go way down. But that may be what the world U.S. should do to, like, kick everybody into making some deal where we all contribute to innovation better. The world, at the moment, the U.S. is just paying for most medical innovation around the world.
I agree. So do you think we should be able to import drugs from other countries at the same price that they sell them there? That's Bernie's proposal.
Again, so, I mean, there's lots of these things where, you can piecemeal pick particular policies, but I'm just more interested in a big overall overhaul and less, approving each particular policy. But, it doesn't sound bad to me, actually, but it would undermine, the ability of U.S. drug companies to innovate and profit from selling drugs higher here than they do elsewhere. That would be one of the ways of basically reducing U.S. overspending compared to the rest of the world. So that's the key trade-off. U.S. is doing most medical innovation because we spend a lot more, and most people who do innovation do it here because that's where you can get paid for doing it. If we undermine that by allowing drug reimportation or cutting or doing a sort of national health care plan, we would then vastly spend less here, which would be to our benefit, but the world would have less innovation.
Wow.
And that might be an improvement for the U.S., but it might be a problem for the world. But I just still think there's just whole different ways to buy medicine that we're not doing that would be much better than either system. And so I'd rather see those things tried on small scales in the hope that we can do better. And something like Futarchy could also just make better choices about which system is likely to work. So I'm about out of time here. This was when I needed to leave to head home for dinner.
Okay.
It's snowing out there, and I'm going to try to not crash into anything in the snow. But it's been nice talking,
James.
Yes,
always a pleasure.
And bye, Adam.
Yeah, thanks, Robin. I really appreciate you joining Future Day this year. Great discussions.